Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
To be engaged or not to be engaged, that is the question. Whether it is more noble to be engaged or not to be engaged. I had to do that, folks. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. I want to show some of my little chops there, should I say, that I know I'm cultured maybe a little bit, not a lot, but I know a little bit of this stuff. Anyway, if you didn't get our promotion, I just sort of like told you what our show is going to be about today, and it's about the subject of engagement. And it's a huge buzzword, should I say, in education from pre-K to PhD. There is, as we said in our promo this week, there is an engagement movement spreading across the U.S., other parts of the world, from flagship research universities and colleges down to pre-K through 12th grade. And for some, engagement is getting back to the basics, the original purpose of education, and I'll sort of give you a little info on that in a moment or two. And for others, it's the last hope to survive the war on public education at all levels. But when I say engagement, when we put the word engagement movement in our promo, what are we talking about here? What do we mean by engagement movement? And why does it matter? Or does it even matter? And as we said in our promo, for some, the notion of engagement has become a life or death proposition. Many high schools, middle schools, the issue to be engaged or not to be engaged can be the determining factor of life or death for schools, teachers, and education, public education. And so, what are we talking about here? Engagement. In many ways, it goes back to the late 1500s, Francis Bacon, and his criticism of the university system as it had developed in Europe. It was, in his view, outmoded. It was antiquated to be, that's being kind. All the instruction was in Latin, and that it was not practical. And it was developing an educated class of elite. It had no applicability to the general population. And his real concern, and it's sort of, I won't give it as a quote more or less, but he was all about what others have characterized him as the advancement of learning for the relief of man's estate. said it again, the advancement of learning for the relief of man's estate. This was 1596, 97, as I recall. And what he was talking about was that we needed to develop knowledge, and we need to pass that knowledge on. That's the learning part here. And we need to do this so that our knowledge and our learning could be used to help humanity. That's what he meant by relief of man's estate. Some type of pragmatic use of our knowledge. Not knowledge for knowledge's sake that has become the gold standard for modern day, being the last couple hundred years, and especially the last 100 years, universities. When I mentioned some time ago that when I was an undergraduate, graduate, and then a professor, my job at a research university was to build on the knowledge that was already there in my discipline, add to it, like that old phrase from Einstein, if I see farther than most, it's because I stood on the shoulder of giants. That's what I was supposed to do, add to the knowledge of the discipline. And in doing that, add to the prestige of my department. And doing that, add to the prestige of the university. In doing that, the university's prestige would rise in both national and international respect. Hence, more money would come to us, on and on and on. It was not knowledge for the relief of man's estate. It was knowledge to enhance knowledge for knowledge's sake, to some extent, in terms of enhancing my discipline. So we can go back to Francis Bacon, and what I've just said is just a bare bones minimum of this man's idea and how he described it, what was it, 300-400 years ago? Benjamin Franklin. We have a caller. Let me take this caller. I'll remember where we are now, and I'll come back to it. Is it Rose?
Hi there. Hi there, Dr.
Miller. Hi. How are you?
I'm okay. Just calling from the quiet corner of Connecticut. Engagement has been a big buzzword for a couple of, decades. The issue has been, however, engagement for what purpose, especially in the public education sector, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I don't know if you've been listening to us on a regular basis, but we started this school year back in September, October, and now we're in November, going over this notion. We start off by revisiting the purpose of education. That if you understood the purpose of education, then you could understand everything that is happening in what we refer to here as the war on public education. So, yes, it's the purpose of engagement that we'll get to a little later that has been kind of at the center of all of this. And I'm glad to hear that you guys are, quote, engaged in this discussion about engagement. So,
the other issue is like shifting the paradigm of the idea that education is something to be consumed, which lends itself really well to the charter movement here in Connecticut, where parents are seeking these alleged opportunities, and instead of claiming the right to public education through this engagement, they've opted towards the consumeristic approach, looking to purchase in one form or another an education.
You know, this show is recorded. I am glad that you have called and said some of the things that you said so that others can hear this later. and I can go back to it. The distinction between education as a purchased consumer product and versus education as Francis said, for the relief of man's estate. Worlds are different. And today we are being driven by the purchase of education as a consumer product and what all of that means. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you very much. And I'll mute myself so I can listen to the rest.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
I was that was Rose, and I think, as you heard, I thanked her very much. Now, back to where we are, Benjamin Franklin. Now, you guys know Benjamin Franklin, very smart individual for his time. He spent quite a bit of his time in Europe, 35 years or something on government, you know, diplomacy sort of thing. Very, very much aware of the education that was being offered in Europe and what it was and was not doing as far as he was concerned. He, too, took the Francis Bacon approach to the purpose of education. And his thing was, education should be such that it enable us to do good, to solve real-world problems. The thing was that knowledge functioned as wisdom and power to do good. There's a quote that I like from him when he says that only when human beings develop and use knowledge to engage in action-oriented, collaborative, real-world problem-solving designed to strategic benefit the human good. That last part is that we develop with our knowledge strategic solutions to be applied to important human needs. So you got two guys here talking about, as Rose said, the purpose of education. They were talking about the universities, higher education at the time. Their two views with migrate to the United States, and from almost the very beginning, when our first universities, the Harvards on the East Coast, were being developed, their purpose was not to educate for the purpose of going out identifying specific or important social problems and applying one's knowledge and wisdom to develop strategic, important solutions? Not at all. So I used the word engagement twice already, and here again, let's talk about engagement. Here is these two individuals, and there are others, of course, but these two individuals, they were saying that our education should be such that it prepares each of us to be able to go out and get engaged, get involved with identifying and coming up with strategic real-world solutions to real-world human problems. That was a very fundamental view among a very small group of people. We come up from the early 1900s, and we talk about Dewey, and we've talked about Dewey over the last 3 months quite a bit. But it was Dewey who was a fan of Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon was a philosopher, and back in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, most people, their education was pretty much philosophy-based. And so it was Dewey, Francis Bacon was a philosopher, Dewey was a philosopher. And when he was studying at Michigan, University of Michigan, and he got his PhD from there and he moved over to Harvard, he was a philosopher, not an educator per se, a philosopher. But he embraced Francis Bacon's idea of learning or advancing learning for the relief of man's estate. And I should add, the advancement of learning was through science, scientific research, not philosophical knowledge, insight, not religious ideology. It was to be through science, as science was being developed during those times. So that Dewey, and here's, remember what Dewey's saying was, as a philosopher. He was concerned about this thing called democracy and its survival. Its democracy was such a radical concept and practice compared to when countries were ruled by kings, queens, and monarchs, and by the church. And here you have this notion of democracy. It was fragile. Could it survive? Then the emergence of dictatorships and capitalism and all these things that would be challenging this new thing called democracy. And Dewey's thing was, how can I, the philosopher, do whatever I can do to safeguard and to perpetuate this thing called democracy? That this is how society should be organized, is along this concept of democracy. And his thing was, for democracy to survive, we needed participatory democracy. We needed everyone participating from the ground up, not the top down. And that education was the vehicle that would help bring everyone into the realm of being able to participate in this thing called democracy. Very central. And as I mentioned not too long ago, he met Jane Addams at Hull House, and he saw how what she was doing and the other women there were doing was exactly what he felt could be used to bring about massive participatory democracy, or the masses participating in democracy. His thing was, he looked at Hull House as basically a school. And this, the light bulb comes on that, wow, the school, not the university, but the school, the public school. Every community had, quote, the neighborhood school or neighborhood school system. This could become the central gathering place where people could learn about and then go out and practice participatory democracy, so that the school for Dewey became the central hub or the central social institution around which ground up participatory democracy could grow, develop, and spread. Think about it. There's always been, since, you know, I say always, but in the last couple hundred years, more schools, public schools, I'll just say kindergarten to 12, than colleges and universities. Makes sense. What do we have now in this country? Something like, I think it's 15,000 public schools. I'm pretty sure that's the last figure that I have in my files. But anyway, the schools became, for him, the vehicle that he needed to spread his idea of participatory democracy and hope in the process save democracy. By participatory, he was saying that people needed to, one, be educated. So like Jefferson, who said that education was going to be the vehicle by which the common man, remember, women didn't matter then, the common man could educate, get an education, and then participate in this thing called democracy. So you've got, again, this notion of engagement. Participatory is a form of engagement. And so you can see historically some of the, quote, I guess historical figures, using that word twice, and they're pushing for engagement. So that we come to kind of like where we are today, maybe say 50 years ago, and that's modern in terms of world time, that our colleges and universities, going back to the close of the 1800s, I think it was 1800s when the government gave land grants for colleges, for states to have the land and the grants to build colleges and universities. No, I wasn't around then, folks. I just studied history. That. The land-grant colleges, they had a mission. Well, had a vision, supposedly, and a mission. And the mission was to basically what Francis Bacon said, that for the relief of man's estate, what Benjamin Franklin talked about, doing good. And here is a connection for all of what I've been talking about. And I remember not too long ago when I said almost everything we are talking about education comes down to it's all political. Well, the land-grant colleges, like the University of Michigan and Cal, all the big schools that were built from the government giving them the land and the money to get started, was to further, quote, democracy. Democracy, democracy, democracy. Provide a democratic education so that we can develop educated and skilled individuals who could go out and engage in participatory democracy. And when I say participatory. They got to be very careful because when you said it so many times, you start messing it up. Is another word for engagement, so that we can grow a population that would be democratic in nature and to see to it that we have a democratic government, democratic processes, democratic institutions. That old government for the people, by the people, a myth, but that was the thing. Other people, by the people, for the people. That's what the land-grant colleges were, their mission was to help further this notion of participatory, engaged government for the people, by the people, of the people. So that we, it's sort of like an evolution, this idea from Francis Bacon to Benjamin Franklin to others, to Land-Grant, to Dewey, and other people of that time period. They were all looking at education to play a role, a significant role, in helping humanity. I'm silent for a moment because I want to say that again. For helping humanity. And as Rose from Connecticut pointed out in her state, education now is a commodity to be purchased. We've talked about this in the past, that as a commodity and as you're paying for it, you should have the right as a student, as a parent, to demand what the education should be, who should deliver the education, and if the student or the parents don't like a particular professor and his or her views, they're purchasing this. Therefore, they have a right to say, we don't want this. Hence, said professor to be removed. That's what happens when education becomes a commodity. And that's where we are now in terms of this neoliberal world that we live in, where everything is a commodity and someone owns and controls the commodity. Far, far cry from what education was envisioned back as far as the late 1500s coming forward. Just thought I'd sort of like slide that in. When we talk about today, and when I said in our promo, what does it matter in terms of engagement? There are those who, especially at the university college level, believe that we should get back to the original purpose of education that Rose and I sort of briefly touched upon, and that we've gotten so far away from this notion of the universities and colleges being engaged. And when they say engaged, this is what they're talking about. The movement, the engagement movement, is saying we need to, and I'm talking about the research university, and let me just take a moment here. Research university. Our universities, like the European universities, are categorized, labeled, and given status to. At the top of the pyramid is the so-called research university. Research universities, flagship universities like the University of Michigan, in my case, University of California, at Berkeley, University of California at Los Angeles, and Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, the Ivies. These are flagship universities. They are all research universities. They are R1. There's a rating system. They are R1, Tier 1 universities. They get the lion's share of government money in terms of grants for research, for development, state money, philanthropic organizations money. They get huge amount of money from alumni. When I say huge, we're talking into the tens, the 20, the 30, 40, 50, 100 million from their just their alumni. They are the ones that countries have looked to discover new knowledge, to advance the interests of the country on many, many different fronts. And in the last 35, 40 years, the research universities, their vision and mission have undergone a radical change in that now they are in pursuit of knowledge for money, not for the relief of man's estate. Prestige comes with the money, and now universities are patenting their scientific discoveries in electronics and medicine and on and on. They've gotten away from what Benjamin Franklin or Francis Bacon or a Dewey had in mind for what the university, what the colleges should do. Now, some of the colleges and universities, and we're talking some of the big ones as well, are saying that, and this is what is meant by the movement, that they need to return to this notion of engagement. They need to take their knowledge, their skills, and share this knowledge is power. I hate to say this because that's what KIPP is, knowledge is power. But knowledge, power, take this power, this wealth, and go into the community and to help the community become the beneficiary of this knowledge, this power, in terms of the community being able to improve by having the university come into their neighbors or their state and using their, quote, wealth and their knowledge to help solve, identify and solve local problems like Benjamin Franklin talked about, and developing these partnerships. When I talked about the community schools, the community schools is a way for other agencies, the university, and especially those universities that have medical schools, where they could then have their medical school set up an office in the school so that their students can have a community-based place to practice their growing knowledge and skill set in real time, real place, real problems. And the University of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin School that he founded, is the number one university that has embraced this notion of engagement. Engagement with your local community, engagement with your region. The movement, the engagement movement, in one sense of the word, is huge now. So that there are formed organizations that rate and grade universities and colleges on the level and the quality of their engagement. Universities and colleges now have tweaked, some of them have tweaked their vision and mission statement to include the word engagement. That part of their vision is to become a place that is engaged with its students, engaged with its neighbors, the community in which they reside in, and the region in which they work in, and to use their resources, their knowledge, and go out and partner with their neighbors in this sort of collaborative partnership so that the community will be a beneficiary of their generation of knowledge and their huge, in some cases, like Harvard. I don't know what it is now, but the last time I looked, before the recession, I think it was a $35 billion endowment. Then it took a hit, but they were coming back, and it had gone past the 35 into 40. I don't know. I don't want to make up any number, but they were well over $35-40 billion endowment. And with that kind of money, you can, as a university, you can do just about anything that you want to do. And so that you'll find that the engagement movement is very much alive and well and growing at the college and university level. What the colleges and universities are doing, they're saying now, and I will bring this down to us, those in the grades, the pre-K to 12th grade in a moment. They're saying to faculty, while they're saying to the president, to the administrators, that we have to get our professors and our students into the idea of engagement. We have to, particularly our professors, we have to now say to them that if you become an engaged professor, we will take your engagement into consideration in evaluating you for tenure, for promotion. And in addition to your research, that we most of the time we only looked at your research, the dollars that you brought in, and the publications that sprung from your research that brought attention to both the university and your department as being worthy of being considered an elite research university. We're going to include now your engagement. We're going to incentivize your engagement so that it becomes a part of our total evaluation of you. That evaluation can be 10%, 20%, depending upon the school and its commitment to engagement. Students, this whole notion of service learning, tying the academics, making it an academic experience, but sending students out into the neighboring communities, be it the schools, the nonprofits, but they're in the community. They're working with the community. They are bringing their knowledge and skills and sharing them in the community setting. So they're visible. They are, quote, part of the community. This is what's happening at the university college level. And when we said in our promotion that for some educational institution, this was a returning to the basic, what I just said was, this is returning to what Francis Bacon said, this is returning to what Benjamin Franklin said, the purpose, as Rose and I talked about, the purpose of education. This is what Dewey was talking about, Jane Addams and others, in terms of the purpose of education. We don't see, at least I haven't, and you may know more than I know in terms of relates to your district, your city, your state. We don't see the engagement movement extensively in the grades yet. And I say yet because I think it's going to happen. And that part of our promotion, when I talked about survival and the past month in October and parts of November, when I talked about the survival of public education, the survival of the teaching core in public schools, that so much was riding on the public school system finding a way to demonstrate to the voting public that they are still of value, they still serve a purpose, an important purpose. And when I talked about the gravitation towards the community schools as a way to help or enhance schools' survival, whole districts. And I mentioned here in Buffalo that as of this summer, they added one more school to the list of community schools. I think now the total number is 11 community schools. And what does that do? When you have, quote, a designated community school where you have in the school medical facilities, dental services, you have social welfare services, you have classes for the adults to enhance their viability as workers, literacy classes, you even have skill classes. And adult schools where kids learn to become mechanics, electricians, and whatever it's considered viable in terms of current and future employment. Having all that based in the schools themselves, what does that do? Well, you know, almost all the research shows that most parents and adults like their neighborhood school. They may think the other schools are crap, but they like their teachers. They like their school. Why? Remember, I'm always saying the most important thing is a why. The why here is they build relationships. They build relationships with the school. They build relationships with the teachers. They see the teachers and the schools differently in terms of they're really trying to help my kid, our kids. They're the good guys. We like them. We'll protect them. So, if more schools become engaged, and here's a word here. An engaged campus. Our campus, our school, is an engaged school. We are engaged with our community. We are engaged trying to identify the problems, their needs, and helping the community develop viable solutions. You tell me whether or not such an engaged campus would endear itself to the community. And if a whole district seeks to become an engaged campus, a network of engaged campuses, whether or not this could have an impact on the favorability scale of our public schools. And if so, in those areas where the public votes on raising the taxes to support the schools, whether or not that's going to have an impact on that yes vote. If the public schools is a place where they can go and get dental service, go and get some emergency service, some primary care services, right there in their neighborhood, right down the street, across the street, around the corner, the school then takes on a different persona. And that persona will resonate throughout the community and enhance, and this is my argument, enhance the survivability of the school, at least within that community, within that city, and possibly the elected officials that go to the state capitol will be more in tune to what their electorate feels and thinks about their schools, and then vote accordingly, develop a legislation to protect the schools, to give the schools the amount of money. I mean, this has never happened in some schools that where the schools actually get the amount of money that is estimated they need per student to be able to provide a quality, sustained education. In New York here, I think the figure is $22,000 a year, but not all districts get that. Some cities, Buffalo's one of them, New York. Remember, I'm just new to Buffalo, so Rochester, Yonkers, Buffalo, and there's another one, I almost had it, and New York, the Big Five, they don't get the full $22,000 that other districts get. Buffalo, I think, gets something in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $15,000 per student as opposed to the $22,000. But the argument still remains that, oh, and then also, how about legislation to take over, turn over the schools to privatization? This is part of what I'm thinking when I say that the survivability of the schools can be enhanced through the community school movement and now the engagement movement. And you say, well, what the hell does any of this have to do with education? But when you view it as education is political, it has everything to do with it. It influences the political process. So, engagement, engagement, engagement. You're going to find more school boards, more superintendents, more principals seeking to become engaged, which means then, teachers, you're going to have to become part, if you're not already part, of the engagement movement. Remember when I've talked about in the past that when I was growing up, teachers made house calls like doctors used to do? If you were out of school a day or two or three, the teacher would show up with lesson plans and homework that you missed out on doing and talk to your parents. And if you had whooping cough or chicken pox, and you're going to be out for more than a few days, maybe a couple of weeks, then set homework assignments, all these things to you. Teachers were engaged at a level then that, of course, we probably will never see again. but they were engaged. Really, truly engaged. Now, a lot has to go into that engagement. And very quickly, there was a time when teachers lived in the community in which they were members of the schools. Or they lived in the community and they sent their kids to the neighborhood public schools. So there was a tie there that enhanced the engagement. We don't have that now. And before my time runs out, there are some impediments, I believe, to teachers really embracing this engagement movement. And let me clarify, we have had teachers forever who are the most engaged people that you'll find on the planet. What I'm saying now is all teachers, I believe, is going to have to become part of the engagement, become part of the engaged campus. And when I was thinking about this, remember Lee Iacocca? He was the chairman of the board of Chrysler in the 80s when the automobile industry was tanking and Chrysler board turned to their chairman, Lee Iacocca. He became the spokesman for it and did all the commercials and what have you. And he had this saying, either lead or get out of the way. Let Chrysler lead. I think that's going to apply to the teaching corps across this country. Either become a part of this engagement movement, or you're going to have to be probably pushed out, or whatever gets you out of the way. Because there is a very strong movement now, pre-K to PhD, to turn schools into engaged campuses. There is a movement to transform teacher education, teacher prep, into a process where teachers learn how to become more engaged from the get-go. There's in-service programs now for existing teachers to become more knowledgeable and skillful at becoming engaged teachers. And I know some teachers hate this word engagement. There was an article just 3 or 4 days ago saying when you use the word engagement, it's insulting to teachers. I know from talking to people who listen to the War Report, they hate this notion of engagement because they're saying that the teachers are not already engaged and haven't been engaged. That's going to be part of the problem of becoming engaged, but it's coming, the engaged campus. We're going to see this notion of the creative school as an engaged school. Say it again. Schools need to become creative centers. They need to move away from the Henry Ford Taylorism of the assembly line, where kids come in, sit at the desk in a row, teacher dispensing wisdom, and the kids are supposed to become sponges and soak it up. There's a call now for, you know this, different type of classroom, a different type of school, the creative school. Well, I'm saying that the creative school will be the new engaged school coming in. There's what this is going to do. There will be a revisioning and an expanding the role of all teachers, so that teachers see themselves as leaders playing an important role or being a role model in the engagement movement. That's a lot, and I've said a lot. I've got to say this very quickly, network, don't cut me off. We're not going to be on the air during the month of November. So today is like the last show for 2017. Our plan is to come back January 2018, and hopefully this time slot will still be available. If not, maybe we'll have a new time slot, maybe even a new day. We will keep everyone abreast, but we will not be on during the month of December. Hopefully, we'll be able to come back January, same day, same time, and you guys who've been here for so long will come back. We've been on the air 3 years, 9 months, longer than anyone ever thought we would be. We want to come back and finish this rest of the 3 months that we have to reach to our fourth complete year. We have over 200 and some hours of programming in the archives. Take this time and go to the archives, but hopefully we'll be back first Sunday in January 2018, same time, same place. Have a good Christmas coming up. Enjoy yourself and come back and be with us when we return in January. Thanks, everyone. See you in January.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.